podcast, Mama. And everyone has one.
greetings, ghouls and boils. I hope you didn't make any mistakes this week, but if you did, you're in luck because we're talking erasers today.
Erase it. Oh no.
It's a magic eraser.
Oh, those things are so.
And we're just riding.
Those things are so good. Do you know, one of my.
What
a magic eraser. They erase everything.
I don't even think I know what a magic eraser is.
It's like a
really
Mr.
Is.
Clean thing, and it like really can like get rid of scuffs everywhere. They're really great. But my biggest pet peeve growing up was a dry eraser head. You know, when they would like not erase, maybe like. Dehydrated,
as opposed to what, a wet eraser?
Well, like, you know, like an eraser, like it like has like a sponginess to it, and sometimes they would like get like dried out, and they're like,
do you know what? I just found out that I really hate. I really back in the day they used to have these pens that would have an eraser, and it never worked.
Yeah.
And it would just tear your paper, and I don't really understand. It was like, why don't you just rip up your paper?
Yeah, just
then?
Start over.
Don't make something. And don't you piss on my head and tell me it's raining. It's like, that was never a thing.
Yeah, no.
Oh, God, we're already on the tangent. We haven't even said who we are yet. Maybe this is your first time listening. Hey, welcome to Dirty Pillows. We're talking about erasers in preparation for our wonderful episode about one of the best movies ever made and one of the most disturbing movies ever made. Infamous to people that haven't even seen it. We are talking about Eraserhead. I am Chris
Fox. And I'm Maddie Glitterati.
Yay! Yes, and we are not in the same room for the
I
first
know.
Time.
We're something new, you guys.
Years we've done this podcast.
We are.
It's weird. I can't touch your leg while I talk. And so I feel... I just have this, like, surrogate bunny over
you
here.
You can touch the rabbit. Touch the rabbit.
I just pull his ears and pretend
all
it's you.
All the times you pulled my ears?
All the times I pulled
all
your ears.
All the times.
So this is Chris and Maddie, and you are listening to the Dirty Pillows podcast, your favorite midnight movie, queer, gay, madness comedy podcast, where you will learn lots of things, whether you want to or not.
I hope so.
Yeah, I can imagine people are like, I'm not listening. I don't want to know.
I don't want to learn.
Well, if you're wondering what Eraserhead is... Or if you're wondering whether it's the right movie for you to watch, we have a lot of ways to tell. And we are going to talk about
it. I was one of those people up until a week ago.
Yeah. If you listen to our last episode, when we were talking about midnight movies and the history of them, we did briefly go into Eraserhead. But we didn't go too deep into it because I have been saving this movie to watch with Maddie for years.
Yes, for 4 years.
It's been on. I've made Maddie all these lists. We're actually on the third one now. About every year and a half, I make a new list of movies that Maddie hasn't seen yet that we need to show him. And Eraserhead is one of the only movies that has fallen into the list over and over and over again because it was never really the right moment. And really, that leads me to question, like, when is the right moment to watch Eraserhead?
I don't know. I don't know if there is.
It wasn't during the pandemic. It wasn't.
No, it was definitely
on anniversaries.
It definitely was not during the pandemic. Oh my God.
It's not a bedtime movie, really. Unless you're that special friend
of
somebody.
College,
and if you are, you're probably.
Freshman year of college is like prime. I feel like that's like a prime time to really watch this movie.
Yeah. A lot of people lose their Eraserhead cherry around college time, for sure.
I did not.
But I decided that the perfect time to show Maddie Eraserhead was Valentine's
Day. Because that's how we share and express our love.
And it's interesting that you mentioned the college thing, because that is something that I was thinking about when I was kind of pondering the influence of this film and when I started seeing it come into like day-to-day consciousness. And that was in film school. Some of you might not know, I am a film school dropout. Most of the best people in the world that you'll ever meet tried film school and were like, deuces, I'm out. When I was at film school, I realized something kind of interesting. There was this way that you could tell the different film school, like, cliques, like the students in film school had, like, these little cliques that kind of formed sort of like a really nerdy mean girls. Mm. And you could tell which clique they belonged to based off of what movie poster was hanging over their bed in their dorm room. Right. And there was, like, only like a couple movies that everybody seemed to use. And it kind of, like, decided it was like a sorting hat for film nerds way before we had Harry Potter, right?
Yeah.
So it was like not a Hufflepuff and a Ravenclaw, whatever. It was like, are you Scarface? You know? Which is like just the boys with like way too much testosterone and like it was like people that didn't understand what that movie was about.
I never had them.
There's many times I come across the Scarface room and you're like, oh, I don't think I want to have the afters.
Maybe not.
You know? There was a group that I tried to kind of sidle up to that was like the Tarantino film student kids. And this is like, in my time at film school was like 1996. So like, you know, Tarantino was very big at that time, but he was like the cool, violent, sort of like a Scarface kid, but like maybe somebody that watched foreign films too.
And there were white groups in that thought they could use the N-word.
Oh, no. That was never okay, but at least not in California. That wasn't okay. Scarface was usually like, it was funny because I think Scarface kind of became like this big thing with like hip hop world around that time too. Like you started seeing Scarface imagery showing up in like hip hop videos and things. So a lot of like the wannabe future directors of color would either like sidle up with like being like Do the Right Thing or, you know, New Jack City or something. And then it was a lot of it was Scarface. Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction was like the same kind of testosterone thing, but maybe they were like a little bit nerdier or like they got these like references that Tarantino was always making. I wanted to be a Tarantino person, but I was too gay to be one of those. There was also like the Manhattan people. They were like the Woody Allen people. Again, this is 96. He was only sort of problematic then. He wasn't like the monster that he is now. But like a lot of like everyone that liked Woody Allen wore glasses. They all had cardigans on when it was warm in the classroom. It was a very Woody Allen type of person. And you'd see like, an Annie Hall or Manhattan poster over their bed. This also shows what a slut I was in college. Then also there was like the THX, like 11th, whatever, like, you know, George Lucas's student film, which he had made in film school as well. So that was like this holy grail of like, I'm going to make the next Star Wars movie, but first I'm going to watch this boring ass movie about robots. So that was like this other kind of nerd, sci-fi nerd, was a Lucas poster, but usually it was THX because that was like the cool one to like, you know, because it wasn't as commercial American Graffiti or Star Wars. There was also like sometimes the foreign film lovers. I didn't really hook up with any of them, but I think they had like Seven Samurai posters or like an Ingmar Bergman movie. Maybe a Fellini poster, maybe 8.5 was over their bed. And the last. Arrivederci, Madonna. I wish I could say I slept with more Fellini people, but I didn't really. I just hooked up with like real Italians, but that was later. And the last group you'd find was the Eraserhead fans. I was one of these people. I think I had, I had a different David Lynch poster, but I was still very much heavily in that group. I also had, like, I think I had a Boogie Nights poster over my
maybe
bed.
Maybe a Greg Araki like, poster forever. Above your bed.
I have that now. but I waited until I knew those people. you couldn't find Greg Araki posters back in the 90s when those movies were actually being made. Like, they were too small. But I was an Eraserhead person. And what did that mean? If you had an Eraserhead poster over your bed, that meant you were in luck. You were going to fuck a weirdo and you were going to have a good time. You know, I think the best film students to hook up with are David Lynch film students. They are
going to set the tone. There might be a weird playlist.
Yeah, it might be a droning, weird industrial tone, but it is going to be a tone. And you don't forget.
You don't know what else.
If you're young and you're in.
You don't know what else is going to pop up. You know,
You never know
what toys gonna are going to like show up just randomly.
They might put some jazz on. They might just turn on a coffee grinder and be like, let's set the mood. You don't know, but it's going to be fun. Nicks, I promise you that. So if you're young and you're in film school right now, when you're walking around dorm to dorm being a little slutty at night, look for the Eraserhead poster, because that is going to be the person you want to hook up with.
I was in the performing arts dorm, and my best friend in high school had worked at a movie theater, so I would always get movie posters. I think that I had a Rent poster, duh. And Across the Universe poster. I was like that. I was... collages of just hot men all over the room. I would like hand make collages, yeah. And it would just be torsos and things from Men's Health.
And a little bit of... Yeah, but Across the Universe, you know, it's like...
Again, it was the musical theater dorm.
Yeah, that's a dorm I didn't used to visit. I was too... Like, no,
I'll pass on the people doing scales. I will walk right past that one.
My film school days were really short. That's why we don't really talk about them very much. I switched loyalties. I went from deciding that I needed a very expensive education to learn how to be a director to deciding to go on my own route, what I called the Tarantino Film School, by dropping out and managing video stores for the rest of the 90s. And they don't say that that's not as successful as Tarantino makes it out to be, because I was like very convinced that I was like, oh, I'm going to write scripts while I'm in film school. Here at this Blockbuster, and I'm famous in like 2 years, and that didn't really work out for me. It worked out for some people. The big nail in my coffin for film school is we did this like film project where we had to make like a little music video, and I did something to Nick Cave, and it was like black and white and very edgy. And my teacher, I was like a straight A student in high school, and my teacher gave me my first C minus on something that I worked really hard on, and just written in red on top said, "The world already has a David Lynch." To which point I was like so torn, because I was like, well, that's like my end all be all of all time would be like to make something as good as something David Lynch makes. And if this already reminds my teacher of that and that's bad, this isn't for me.
Fuck that guy.
So if that teacher's ever listening to this, I just want you to know that I probably could have finished school, but it was your fault for discouraging me.
Words have weight.
Now look at me.
I mean, I think you're doing pretty fucking good. That's my opinion.
Thanks, baby. And I mean, yeah, Eraserhead, I don't think their film student would have liked this either, you know? I think it's like a fine wine that's curdled to be into. I read something really funny that was actually on my favorite social media app, Letterboxd. And I thought that was a good way to kind of start this episode. Someone named Madison Wake. Madison Wake, if you're listening to this, you are a genius, because you came up with the funniest sentence I've ever read. They said, there is a fine line between surrealism and madness. David Lynch snorted that line. And that is the best explanation of not just Eraserhead, but of Lynch's entire filmography. Yeah, you know, it's a fine line between surrealism and madness, and that line was right up his nose.
That is
allegedly. We're not gonna say that David Lynch has a drug problem. I actually think that he's probably the least likely person to sniff anything. If you've ever seen David Lynch in an interview, he is like Oakley Dokley. Right, he's almost like Ned Flanders. Well, he's like the dad in a 50s TV show. Like, he says,
I'll golly. Just have a, you know, a tuna melt with maybe a slice of pie for dessert, cutest. And a cup of coffee.
He's the cutest, most innocuous, most gentle seeming human being. And I love that a lot of people that are creators that make these really dark things that scare everyone end up being that way. He's like a George Romero or a Wes Craven, where they're just like someone you wouldn't be scared to introduce them to your parents or something. Like, they're adorable, but there's
it's dark, and I don't know if there is meaning.
But meaning to what? The movie?
I mean, I don't know if there has to be.
I think a lot of times, I mean, we can get into this a little later when we go deeper into like the actual film and stuff in his filmography, but I think he likes to toy with the viewer a lot. I think that some people are like, we're leaving this open-ended so you can decide how it ends in your own. He does that from the beginning. Like, we're leaving this story open-ended the entire time. So it's basically...
I think that he gives the audience a lot of credit. I think that he thinks that...
Sometimes I think he hates us. Sometimes I think he's really an artist that makes art for himself, and he doesn't really care that other people are going to watch it. Or, like, just anytime that someone tries to ask him to, like, explain something, it's the only time I see, like, this darkness fall over him where he's just like... And granted, a lot of artists don't like explaining their art. I don't like explaining my art, but I don't make art purposefully to confuse people and then get frustrated when they're confused. But
I mean, that
it is also been, for as long as I can remember being into film, it's been a thing of like being the person that figured out the movie, you know, like, and I say this with like little air quotes, like I was that person very much in the 90s where I, anything confusing by David Lynch, I had five theories about what it all meant. And people would believe me, but I was completely making shit up. Like, it's like 100% just what I interpreted it as. And be like, let me explain Lost Highway to you, or let me explain Mulholland Drive. And people are like, okay, oh, yeah, but it's not real. Like, I just made it up. Like, it could be
but
anything.
But for you, it is real. And for somebody else, it may be different. And for this other person.
Well, you know me well enough, being my lover, that like anything I believe is real
is the truth.
Real. It's possible.
No, I think that he makes these things so open-ended to, I think he thinks his viewers that are watching it are smart and are going to have ideas and are going to come up with ideas. In his world, all of them could be right all at the same time.
Yeah. David Lynch is the one that began... Why not? Why not? Yeah.
Very much that. Very much that.
But in our relationship, I've shown you so many David Lynch movies, but we had kind of been saving this one for so long. And it's his first one. Before we watched it, what did you think was going to happen in this movie? Like, what were your expectations before sight unseen?
I thought that it was a nickname for this guy who had crazy hair. And everyone just called him a eraser head. And it was about his life because his head looked like an eraser.
Like kids just like threw erasers at him at school.
Or something.
Oh my God, that reminds me of something. That used to be a thing that kids used to do to me when I was little. If you're listening to this, I have very, very curly hair. And in the 80s, I didn't have products or a parent that taught me how to care for curly hair. So my hair was just very thin and out of control. And it would be like sculpted with a brush, maybe like to like maybe make a shape out of it. But throughout the day, it would just become
Did
like
you a big, have
like,
a razor I was with, like, sort hair?
Of like, one of those things in the Western-y days, like a tumbleweed. I like sort of looked like a tumbleweed a lot of the time. And kids would throw stuff in my hair all the time, like staples and little spitballs. But a lot of times it was the ends of a pencil. So they would like take the eraser off the pencil and then put like a staple in it. And then make like a little Sputnik satellite and throw it in my hair. And then if I like shook my head, all this weird shit would fall on the top of my desk. So I was a little bit of an eraser head. Yes,
that's what I always thought it was about. You know, I thought that it was about like, I never really investigated too much into it. But, you know, you see the shirts, you see the posters in the dorms. And I feel like sometimes I'd be like, what's a razor head? And people be like, you don't know what a razor head is? Ugh. And I'd be like, I'm sorry. And then I was like, oh, I don't know if I want to see it. But I'm glad that I finally did. I really am. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I think that it all happened when it was supposed to. I am very pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, I think you saw it at the right time for you. I find it really interesting to see when people see this movie and how that alters the way that they see other movies. And because once you see Eraserhead, even if you hate it, it's something that kind of stays with you.
Yeah.
Whether you like it or not. And I think the perception of it is very different depending on if you saw it as a cool college kid or if you saw it in an inappropriate younger time or like, and I have a feeling we have a special guest that's going to join us today. We do have a special guest. And it's funny, we originally were planning this episode and it was just going to be us. But then one of our friends started gushing about how much she loves this film. And we were like, hold that. Save it for the podcast. No. Come on, join us. So
yeah, I mean, like, I had literally just finished a night of work, and I ran into our friend, was telling them what we were doing, and just started going off of the stories. And I was like, oh my God, hold. Are you available tomorrow? I need you for like short little bit to talk to me and Chris about all of this. And they said yes. So right. This is super exciting.
So exciting. So yeah, this is a special addition to our podcast. We are going to have the legendary Miss Anna Matronic on today. One of our friends. She's amazing.
So beyond. So fucking cool.
If you're not aware of who Anna Matronic is, Maddie, give him a little bio. Well,
Anna Matronic, born in Portland, Oregon, was a life force in the glam rock radically queer group, the Scissor Sisters. Formerly a T-Shack alum in San Francisco Denizen, Miss Anna has never stopped turning heads and tapping toes. She's a DJ, also an advisor on The Voice and Eurovision. I didn't realize this. She was an advisor on Eurovision, which is so cool.
She's major.
Yes.
Major.
Had her own BBC radio show for eons. And you can find her in the summertime, in the summer months, on Fire Island at her residency at the legendary Ice Palace in Cherry Grove.
Woo-hoo. Yeah, if you go to the Ice Palace to watch her play some music, you'll probably find us because I'm over there twirling.
Yeah, her amazing pretty queer though.
She even sweats like David Lynchy, Twin Peaks magic each time. And she is the coolest. She's the cat's pajamas. She's the bee's knees. Please join us in welcoming the one and only Miss Anna.
Yay!
Hey, Miss Anna. How are you?
Thank you so much for doing this. We're so excited to have you here.
Welcome to Dirty Pillows.
Thank you for having me. Yeah. I love Dirty Pillows. They're my favorite kind of pillow.
I was just saying how we were talking at Red Eye, and I was talking about how we were going to do this, mm-hmm. and you immediately just started talking about your experiences with this movie, and I was like, we have to have you on here.
Yeah. Yeah. Eraserhead was part of my formative experiences. I was way too young when I saw it.
I was young. How old were you when you first saw it?
All right. So let me just back up a little bit because I explain how it happened. So I grew up in a very artistic household. My mother was a painter. These icons behind me were painted by my mother. And so my mother was one of those like hippy dippy ladies who loved wearing caftans and lots of ethnic, you know, jewelry from Africa and Indonesia and all that stuff. And she was a very, very interesting lady. And she liked and encouraged an artistic lifestyle and very left field things. And so she was of the mind that there isn't anything that her daughters could be shown that we couldn't discuss, especially if it was in the context of a film. She was always able, even if it was rated R, there was always something to talk about and explain. And she was very, very open and always believed that anything that you go through in life, you can talk it out. Right. And so I was very, very fortunate to have a mom like that. And I love her and miss her every day. Love you, Sherry. And so when I was growing up, we lived in Portland, Oregon. Keep Portland weird. And there was a Repertory Art House Cinema, and I think it's still there, Cinema 21 on 21st Street in the northwest section of Portland. And Cinema 21 was a really fun place to go see a film because they had a lot of fun with things. And the very first time I remember going there was when I was 8 years old. It was April Fool's Day, and they showed a double feature of this 50s exploitation film called Chain for Life, which was about two conjoined twins who were a singing group, and they were conjoined twins in real life too. And Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. So that was the double feature. But they also showed Edsel commercials and Sally Rand's Bubble Dance and all of this stuff. And everybody was making paper airplanes out of the schedules and like flying them off the balcony, and beach balls were being released. And I was like, this place is amazing. This is great. Is it always like this? You know, so I loved Cinema 21 from the get. And so my mother would get they had one of those newspaper type mailers where it would fold out into quarters, and it had a big sort of full page spread of what was on over the next 3 months.
Yeah.
And so my mother always said to me and my sister, whatever you want to see, we will go see. So it is 1986, I'm guessing. 1986. And it's my sister's turn to pick out what we go see, or, you know, she's like, I want to see this. And it was a double feature of Eraserhead and Liquid Sky. My sister was 13 years old and I was 11. Oh. And, both of us were way too young to see Liquid Sky. And I remember Eraserhead, like my mom just like looking at us after it was finished when the lights go up for intermission. And she was just like, what the hell did we just watch? And then she was like, so what do you know? And yeah, it was quite an experience. But then Liquid Sky started, and that was the only thing that we actually talked about in the car home, because there's, you know, mom wants a cunt, blah blah blah. Yeah. Like
there's some lessons that need to be learned after watching.
Really adult themes going on in Liquid Sky. But my sister wanted to see it because it was like the new wave movie, right? And so, and Blue Velvet had been out at that point by 1986. And I had already seen Dune. I went to go see Dune in the theater when I was 10. That was a huge deal. And so I already knew David Lynch a little bit, who in my family was like the guy who made that horrible version of Dune.
Right.
My mom was a big sci-fi nerd, so she was really excited to see it and super disappointed by it. I went to see it when I was 11 years old. It was way too early, but very, very formative.
At least you're like a parent that you could talk about.
When did you see it, Chris?
After.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think 8 or 9 when I saw it, but I didn't, my mom was like the opposite. And that's like a thing that comes up in our show here a lot, Anna, is like, I had like this quote unquote, like cool uncle, my mom's like younger brother who babysat us a lot. And he was like, he had like some kind of social thing where he wouldn't really go outside. He didn't like other people, but he was like a savant with like music and movies. So like a lot of my early introductions to like film and to music were from him. Like he would play me really cool records, lots of post-punk stuff, and getting that into me at a time, you know, when I was listening to Paula Abdul or something, and he'd be like, here's the Tom Tom Club and here's the Cure. And here's like, and so formed me a lot. And then movies were the same way. And I was kind of a chicken as a kid. And I think he found it funny, which is totally something that I've inherited from him. Like I delight in scaring Maddie and making Maddie watch things that fuck him up more than anything. Like I love the feeling of watching somebody experience something for the first time and being like, oh my God, you know?
And that is nonstop the experience of Eraserhead. And it doesn't really matter how many times you've seen it. You're still like, what the fuck am I watching? Yeah,
he was literally like, I'm going to show you this movie, but you can't tell your mom that you watched it. Because my mom was very strict, and our family was strict and very religious. We weren't supposed to watch anything with cursing, anything with sex, anything that was like overly violent. So we would watch this stuff and then have to like hold it in, you know, and be like, why are you having nightmares? Oh, I don't know. Because
I don't know. I just watched a man like open some weird baby up and then stab it with a pair of scissors.
I wouldn't say that I enjoyed it, you know, like watching it. I didn't like it. I thought it was gross. I thought it was weird. I also thought a lot of things that I really love now were really boring when I was young, because like that, you know, you're 9 years old. You're not entertained by stuff like that generally, you know, like I just,
you're not really ready to analyze a film.
No, I'm just like, you nothing's know, happening. Yeah. This is so boring. And then suddenly it was like, oh, this too much is happening. And this is so gross. And I don't know what's going on.
What's with the cheeks, lady? What's with the cheeks?
Yeah, I loved her so much. The little lady.
I know Maddie watching it. Maddie was like, I love the lady in the radiator.
In the radiator. Yeah. Fast forward about 10 years, 12 years, and I was performing at T-Shack in San Francisco, and we had a David Lynch themed night. Actually, it was Helmut Newton Takes a Ride Down the Lost Highway. That was the thing. And so it was like roughly a
specific theme.
I know. That was, and it was hosted by the Steve Lady, who was a very specific queen, RIP. Yes. Heclina hosted it as the lady in the radio. Pretty great.
Oh my God. Do you remember? What did you perform? Do you remember?
I had a really cute boyfriend named Brent, and he and I kind of did a sort of like wordless pantomime to the Twin Peaks soundtrack. And it was more theater and interpretation than like outright drag. There was no lip syncing. And the Steve Lady came up to me afterwards and was like, that was exactly it. You totally understood the excitement. And I was like,
my God.
I'll send you a picture. I do have a picture of me and Brent from that night, and I have a picture of Heclina and Steve Lady from that night too. So I'll send them to you.
Oh my God, we did a David Lynch night at Monster Bar in San Francisco, like at Cookie Dough Show, and it was like one of those gigs, you know, where you have to do two different numbers. So it was like the whole thing of like intermission, then you'd have another number. And it was like so hard to think of how you're gonna like transition one look to another look. But
oh, sure.
I was so excited to be booked for it because I was like the biggest David Lynch head. So I was like, so excited. And both of my numbers just went over everybody's head. And like all the queens kind of just like Isabella Rossellini in Blue Velvet or like Laura Palmer Wrapped in Plastic or whatever. And I did a number based on Lost Highway where I was like both Patricia Arquette, which I found really easy. Everyone was kind of like, I don't get it. And then the other number was I did Crispin Glover in Wild at Heart.
Making sense. Good times.
And stripped down to cockroach underwear. And I think everyone was just horrified. And like, I just saw Peaches Christ, like smiling at me like, yeah. And I was like, she's the only one that understands what I'm doing.
I think that right maybe now. You really got a vibe of how David Lynch feels. After anyone sees his movie, it's like, all right, this is the person in the back. They got it. Great.
Like, Wild at Heart is good.
I was watching Eraserhead last night too, because it had been a few years since I'd seen it, and I was reading up on it, and Eraserhead got him the job to do the Elephant Man, basically. Or he after he did Eraserhead, he wanted to direct a script that was already written. And so he did the Elephant Man, and it was Mel Brooks's company that was producing it. And David Lynch wanted a little bit more money for the production. So he had Mel Brooks go to a screening to see Eraserhead. And Mel Brooks comes out of the screening going, you got it, kid. No problem. And if that is Mel Brooks's reaction to Eraserhead, you know you're doing something right. Like, that is...
I love
that. And 1977, you know? Yeah, it's like, that's like that coming out of 1977.
Best movies, you know? So... That's like when Mel Brooks did like Young Frankenstein and Blazing Saddles the same year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 1974, I think Blazing Saddles was. Was also a huge film in my house growing up. We all loved Mel Brooks, and we would always watch Blazing Saddles after Thanksgiving dinner. It was one of those ones we could all agree on. Nice healthy dose of Americana and watching the, you know, the racists get their own at the end. I don't know. And we also weirdly, we all collectively in my household loved David Lynch. We were a Lynch household because our surname is Lynch. And so me and my sister started affectionately calling David Uncle Dave. And I was a sophomore in high school when Twin Peaks when Twin Peaks premiered. So being in high school in Washington State, watching high school kids, a lot more sophisticated and sexy than anybody I went to high school with. But it was such a moment, you know, and it was such a huge zeitgeist for people in the Northwest, and especially anybody alternative or weird. It was a real thing. And so I really had a kind of David Lynch adolescence, and, you know, loved Wild at Heart, saw Wild at Heart. I remember my parents went away on vacation, and so I had a film festival at my house, and it was all, you know, all the weirdest films, and it was we showed Eraserhead and Wild at Heart, The Cook, The Thief, His Wife and Her Lover, Brazil, and yeah, whatever we could. I can't quite remember the entire oof. Yeah. But it was really fun. So I was an obsessive from a very young age.
Yes, I love. My first time dressing up with a wig on was dressing as Laura Palmer for school, for Halloween, and I dressed up and Twin Peaks was out when I was in junior high, so. Yeah, I was like 13 or something, and I came to school wrapped in plastic with a blonde wig on and blue lips.
And amazing!
What I was doing.
Amazing.
My mom just being like, "Why are you dressed like that? What are you?" I'm like, "I'm just a dead person for Halloween," and I think I got made fun of horribly. But I remember like being. I have a very vivid memory of being in choir class, like in period of choir, and everyone was like rehearsing something, and I couldn't stand up good because I was so wrapped up in plastic.
That's amazing.
She's like, "I'm Laura Palmer. You know, watch this. Do 12-year-olds not watch Twin Peaks?" Like,
shuffling down the halls very slow, like,
yeah.
I love that so much. We totally would have been friends.
Amora, yeah. Every time we talk, I'm like, man, we would have been friends no matter what time we met in our lifetime. Like. Yes. It's very easy.
For sure.
So
for sure.
All David Lynch fans kind of have this big thing of like kind of like listing their movies. And I feel like you've already mentioned Wild at Heart a couple times that you like it, which I think is great. And just further proof that we're friends, because I used to get a lot of shit about that movie. Because
we're fucking weird, right?
It's one of those movies even amongst the Lynch people, they have problems with it, you know, like, or that it was like his sellout movie or whatever.
Oh.
But it was my favorite probably growing up, when I was younger. I think I was very much Team Wild at Heart. But what is your favorite David Lynch movie now?
I still really, really connect to Twin Peaks. It is just like my favorite, probably my favorite thing, especially season one. I don't really see season two, and I actually haven't seen Return to Twin Peaks yet.
Really?
Probably because I'm afraid, but I need to see it. And it's Wild at Heart. I love Laura Dern, and I love Blue Velvet too. It's really hard to say because that combination of Kyle MacLachlan and Laura Dern is extremely great. And Dennis Hopper in that film is so amazing. And Isabella Rossellini, we could watch a beautiful phone book. Yeah,
especially.
And, but yeah, I think it's Twin Peaks. I think it's Twin Peaks for me. Cause that is, I think, the one that I identify with the most.
Yeah.
And I think it's also one of the more accurate, portrayals of not necessarily what it's like to live in the Northwest, but how it feels in the forest. Yeah. There, people don't really get forest on the East Coast in the way that we do in the Northwest.
Yeah, 100%.
When you go into a place, when you go into a forest, when you go into a 300,000-year-old rainforest with evergreen trees, and the temperature drops, and it sounds like it's raining, even though it's not raining, and you know, it's just nighttime in the daytime, you are completely and totally out of your element. And I've never seen a more perfect description or a more perfect portrayal of that creepiness of the Northwest landscape and forests, and you know, you never know what's lurking behind the next bend, you know.
Yeah, that's just something that David Lynch, I feel, is it's something I love about him the most, is that he creates the feeling of things so well. Like, yes. Where people have, I'm sure we'll talk about this like later when we're like going through like the movie, like, but he's so good at like not really defining what things are and not explaining something to you at all, but yeah. He will give you a feeling. They're always like these movies wash over you. They're kind of an experience, and you walk away going, you feel everything that he wants you to feel. He just, that's
definitely
feel like kind of what it's supposed to be or tell you to do.
I like that in storytelling. It really bothers me when the narrator comes on and is like, and those are totally out for you, you know? And yeah. That to me is like a level of sort of hand-holding that I don't feel I need in filmmaking. And he just kind of lets you go. And I like that about him.
It makes you have ownership of it too, in a weird totally. Way. You know, like when you have to kind of feel things on your own, it gives you a personal attachment to something, right? You know, like,
yeah. we were talking about it, I think, last week, or kind of the difference between how movies are something that you really kind of see together and music is something that you kind of identify for yourself, you know, and how does that affect you? But when it's a movie like any of David Lynch's films where you have to really get in there and defend it or kind of make it make sense for you, it gives you that personal resonance.
Definitely. And his movies are resonant. That's a great term, because it's just so bizarre. You don't have any real footholds, and that's on purpose. I think he's doing that to make you to put in a sense of unease and to make you uneasy and to also kind of just twist things into a real absurdity. When I was reading about Eraserhead, he lived in a really rough part of Philadelphia, where 3 days after he and his wife moved in, and they had their daughter, infant daughter, 3 days after they moved in, they were burglarized, and they were routinely burglarized, had their windows shot out. It was a really, really dangerous part of the city. And that Eraserhead was kind of created out of that paranoia of what happens when you leave the house, what is waiting for you, what is lurking around the corner. And that I also think, being a new father, playing into, well, his daughter was 10 when it came out, but there's this like fear of parenthood, I think, in there as well. Fear of fatherhood, for sure. Really, really present in Eraserhead, that comes through in such a really, really terrifying way.
It's a funny thing that I kind of always joke about, that it's like it's his fear of like big city life, it's his fear of like quote-unquote like male growing up, like it's like these male
fears,
like of marriage and settling down and having a kid and having a job and
being and getting your in-laws and, like, and having them try and make it with you. What?
I love the line that, like, so Henry, what are you working on right now? And he's like, oh, well, I'm on vacation. He's like, I'm on vacation.
It's like same.
What? Yeah. Strange.
It was. Yeah. The entire X fit. I think that there's also such a fear of abandonment. I mean, that from my first time seeing it, that was the big kind of theme that I felt was just, this guy feels trapped in this apartment with a baby, and his wife got out, but he's here stuck now and slowly going insane with something that seriously, I don't know what this is. Because if it is, as a first-time father, that's what you would look at your baby like. I have no idea what this is. This is something completely, like, is it going to get sick? Why is it crying? What does it need? I have no fucking idea, you know?
And you know that David Lynch was probably sitting there writing something out with a pencil and like looking at the eraser and going, oh, I wonder if that was made out of somebody's brain. And he like writes it into the script, right? You know?
Exactly.
Yeah. One of those guys. One of those guys.
Before we had you jump on, that we were talking about Maddie's preconceived ideas, like kind of, it's one of these movies, right, that everybody's seen the poster, or like, you know, you cool had the t-shirt on or something. I was joking in the beginning of the show that, like, when I was in film school, there were like these archetypes of different film students, and you could tell based off of what poster they had in their room, you know. And I was like, Team Eraserhead kids, and we were like the best in bed because we were the weirdest, and like, you know, like, but that you kind of had an opinion on the movie before you even saw it. And so it was like interesting to me of like what Maddie's original idea was, like, what did you think it was going to be? And he thought it was going to be about a man.
Because he had like an eraser.
That had an eraser in his head.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean,
who knows?
That could be the plot.
To you.
And could be a plot of a future David Lynch film. But I could see it.
I think
it's so deeply, deeply weird. And I don't know that it's necessarily meant to be understood, as it is just this sort of weird vignettes and series of meditations on modern living, I suppose. Fatherhood and worms.
Okay. So guess what?
Worms?
Guess
what? I don't know. Worms?
What? All of those umbilical cords for the creatures were real. Those were real.
I'm not surprised. Yeah.
It was Catherine Coulson's job. She would go to hospitals, and it was such a frequent thing that she would just sit with a tub outside of the delivery rooms, and they would come and just give them umbilical cords, and then they would, and then she would take it to set.
No!
Yes.
Actual human. Umbilical cords and things. That seems strange to me when the butcher exists and like chitlins exist. Like, you can just go and get yourself some chitlins. It's the same, almost the same thing. That's what I thought it was.
Definitely hospital rules, laws, definitely much more relaxed in the late 70s than they are now.
For sure. I also read that Sissy Spacek worked on this film. That she was friends with David Lynch and worked on the film.
She was her husband. Jack Fisk, who's like an art director. And he's one of the characters in the movie too. But he her husband worked on all sorts of crazy cool movies. They met when she did Badlands.
Mm-hmm.
And,
oh, wow. Okay.
And she was underage or whatever, and like when she became of age, they became a couple. And he worked on like Carrie. He like did like a bunch of really cool movies. Basically was just like hanging out on set all the time while they were making Eraserhead.
Yeah, she has a thank you in the credits.
I was like, I wish I just thrown it too.
I love that. So weird. it's so good. I was saying to my husband last night, what do you think? He's been married 4 times. And was with Isabella Rossellini for about 5 years. Getting wooed by David Lynch? Like, what happens?
I think the first
You get a dozen roses and a box of intestines show up, and like, ah,
I think
you're in my gut. I've got a gut feeling. I like you. You know, I don't know. Is it like that? What's it like?
I mean, in interviews and stuff, he's always so like, I always call him like kind of like oakley dokley. Like, he's so in a different time, and so like white bread Americana. He's like, oh gosh. And like Laura Dern always talks about like how all of his business meetings, especially back in the day, were always at Bob's Big Boy. That's like his thing. So Laura Dern said like Bob's Big Boy with him at least 10 times because she's like his muse, you know. But new actors are always like taken aback by it and be like, yeah, well, he's going to ask you to go to Bob's Big Boy. You're going to talk about stuff. You won't ever audition. He just like has weird conversations with you and then is like, yeah, you're right for the part. And so no one ever really auditions for him. And you always go to Bob's Big Boy.
So I mean, it's definitely pie involved. There has to be.
I'm sure. And coffee. Coffee.
Lots of coffee.
Okay, bye.
But yeah.
I heard about him going into, because we were friendly with Interpol and would see them out touring and stuff like that. Back in the day when I was with Scissor Sisters and touring, and they made a I don't know if they made an album with him, but they did a song with him. And so they went to a meeting with him. Don't know if it was at Bob's Big Boy.
Oh, that I hope.
I think he comes into their studio or something and just immediately sits down and is like, so are we going to make some music? And they're like,
sure. Yeah.
Yes. yeah. So he's very enthusiastic. I think he's just kind of, I wouldn't be surprised if there's a great deal of collaboration in what he does, or a lot of kind of playing, spending time with the actors and kind of, you know, getting stuff either out of them through improvisation or just taking cues from their personalities and writing them into the script.
Yeah. It seems like he's just studying people and like having conversations and then kind of writes a lot of that stuff into their characters. You know, I know Twin Peaks, a lot of the characters changed, like for better or for worse, but like based off of their own personalities. And it's like when he stops liking somebody, you can see by the way he films them that changes. Which I see in Twin Peaks very, very strongly. Like the difference between season one and season two, part of it is that he left, you know, and was busy and doing Wild Heart and things. And so he couldn't be there. But, and so that was a detriment. But it was also the way certain actors in the film like treated him. And like they're, you know, and everyone was like breaking out and becoming big and getting a more opportunity.
Yeah.
And he would get resentful and kind of that would affect their character arcs in the
story. Right. Yeah. Laura Flynn Boyle.
Yeah.
Yeah. The difference between Donna in the series and Donna in Fire Walk With Me. Yeah. Little different.
Yeah. It's
crazy. No Tina Fey, Maura Kelly. You were right. But yeah,
just a completely different character.
Miss Anna.
Yeah.
Oh. How do you feel about Fire Walk With Me?
Sorry?
How do you feel about Fire Walk With Me?
I remember going to see it in the theater when it came out and being really disappointed because it ultimately was a David Lynch film.
Yeah.
And I wanted a little bit more of the first season TV thing. But you have to remember that's like ABC coming in and being like, hey, we've got to, you know, steer it this way, that way, the other. And when I got the feeling that with Fire Walk With Me, it's just, this is what we're going to do. I also just find the whole Leland Bob thing really, really disturbing.
Yeah.
And, you know, anytime incest is involved, it's really gross. And Laura as a character is somebody who I think if she were 23, it would make sense that she's going through all this. As a high school senior, I find it a little like a little problematic that she's like, you know, having sex with everybody in town.
I mean, wait, are you trying to tell us that your experience in high school wasn't working for Meals on Wheels and doing cocaine in the bathroom and also being a sex worker and also,
and like having a really sophisticated relationship with your therapist, like that doesn't feel teenaged to me.
Yeah.
So screw up young back then. They really did.
I always think it. That Fire Walk With Me is the more disturbing movie than Eraserhead. And people, like, you know, because everyone kind of holds Eraserhead to be this, like, it's the most fucked up, weird movie that David Lynch has done. And while it's the most surreal and the most, like, odd, you know, and most non-linear, nonsensical, Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me affects me more. Like, I tried to rewatch that, like, a year ago, and it bothered me, like, in a way that I wasn't expecting it to. Like, yeah, it's just, it's darker. And I think a lot of that is because Cheryl Lee's so incredible in it and her performance.
She is.
That you believe, you know, and it's.
And I wonder if that kind of film could get greenlit today. I don't really feel like it could.
Just because of the
themes that they're having these young people deal with are so intense that it just doesn't really register to me that that people would be like, yeah.
Yeah, sure. No, and it's like, and Twin Peaks is funny because, yeah, you had mentioned you hadn't watched the third season, you know, or the reboot of it.
Not yet.
I will. It has the best hour of something I've ever seen on television in my entire life in it. So one episode is incredible. And it's him returning to black and white for the first
time. Oh, cool. Fun.
It's a standalone. What? It doesn't have anything to really do with.
Yeah, it's almost like a prequel type of situation. It is just a masterclass in filmmaking. It is like incredible. But a lot of it was very much in the vein of like, I'm not going to give the audience what they're asking me to give them. Like, I'm not going to do another version of Twin Peaks. It's going to be my own version of it. And as a viewer, reading every week, I was so frustrated. I remember just being so angry. And I think it's funny that of all the movies, we basically, big David Lynch fans can kind of defend every step in his career. Like, the people that hate Wild at Heart, we can be like, but this is great because of this and this and this. Twin Peaks is something that we're all so personally attached to, we love so much, that we get angry about it. Like, season two made us angry. The last two episodes of season two are fantastic, but then it ends on that cliffhanger, and that was it. And then we all thought in Fire Walk With Me, it would be like, you're going to explain this cliffhanger, obviously.
Yeah. Right.
No, I'm going to do a preview. No. I'm just going to show you how horrible life was.
And like, Agent Cooper is just going to be in the very beginning, and we're not really going to deal with explain him again.
All of anything. And then then the return finally happens, and you're like, this is the plan. And he just teases. And it is in a way, like, there's like a scene with like Ashley Judd and a guy talking, and then someone just vacuuming for like 5 minutes. And you're like, what are you doing? Like, why is this 18 episodes? And why are you doing this to us? Like, and it's like, I was a big Audrey head. I was obsessed with obsessed with that character. And she ended up with a figure too. And I was like, I need to know what happened to Audrey. That's all I really care about. And they promoted it very heavily of like, these cast members are all coming back. And they don't show her until I think like a couple episodes before it's over. And even then it's like two scenes.
No,
I had was
palpable.
It was so much. I was so frustrated, and I had to keep telling myself, "Like, this is David's art, and you don't get to tell David what he does."
Yeah,
this is for him. Just
and he's not going to tell you the story the way that you expect it to be told, because that's just not what he does. When I watch the second season of Twin Peaks, it seems very clear to me that he's annoyed at the network. Twin Peaks would have been perfect if they had wrapped it up in one season, right? It would have been absolutely beautifully perfect. And the fact that it was such a sensation, of course, the network gets greedy and is like, we have to do season two and we have to do 22 episodes. And it's just like, I really? And so then you can actually see David Lynch going, oh, okay, it's going to be 22 episodes. We're going to make a soap opera. And it literally becomes a soap opera down to the schmaltzy soundtrack and the whole thing. And so I definitely think that based on the soap opera-ness and the problems with the network of season two of Twin Peaks, he wanted to make Fire Walk With Me just like so fucking, you know, he's like, I'm going to make it like I'm going to make it. Like, and no, it's going to be a David Lynch film.
No one's going to tell
me. It's not
going to
be an ABC network series. Yeah.
You don't always know what you want.
What was so funny was I didn't see season two when it first came out because I was an exchange student my junior year in high school, and I went to South Africa for a year, and Twin Peaks didn't come on then, and I was like, wait, you guys see this thing? It's so good. And I was like this, like, you know, David Lynch ambassador to my friends in South Africa. And
you had to wait so long to finally watch it.
I had to wait so long, it was fine because everybody told me how bad the second season was, and that we were not going to get the resolution that you wanted to. And it's like, but who kills her?
Just enjoy
so
Africa.
Bob, and, yeah, Bob, and he's kind of like possessive. What? Like, okay. Like, all right. I'll just wait to see it. And then I sort of kind of purposely put it off because I knew it was bad. And then, you know, then it comes on streaming and I'm okay. Like, all right, finally, we'll do this.
I think
we'll
now that it. I've come to terms with the fact that it wasn't what I wanted it to be back in the day, and it had been enough time when I tried to rewatch, like I was showing Maddie Twin Peaks like last year or whatever, and I kind of liked it a lot more. The second season, I liked it a lot more, but it was also because I got to just kind of live with these characters that I liked, and I didn't expect anything. And I think The Return is very similar. Like, if you just kind of let go of what your wish list is, then just be like, you're not going to get any of the things that you really want. So just see what he wants to show you.
I mean, that's how I've been going into all of these, into this David Lynch universe, seeing kind of being introduced to it such later years. You know, it's like, I have no idea what's going on. I don't know what's going to be going on. And I'm expecting just to have that be the case, you know, and going into it like that, I'm like, okay. That was like my biggest reaction after seeing Eraserhead was like, well, that was a David Lynch movie. Okay. I don't know what it means. And I think that's okay. And I think it might change. But as of right now, I have no fucking clue what I just saw. It was just fucking weird. I think that that's kind of a good attitude to go into with any of his movies.
Or any artist in general. I think it's like it's a good training ground to like get used to art that isn't palatable. You know, like maybe you don't need to always figure everything out.
And I really think that David Lynch defined a generation that then went on to love things like City of Lost Children and, you know, everything really, really weird. We're the same kids who go and see Poor Things and laugh through the whole thing. You know, I laughed so hard going through Poor Things. Two ladies, a couple rows down, came over and introduced themselves after the film because they were like, "We could see that you enjoyed that film just as much as we did. We wanted to come say hi." And there was the guy in front of me was like looking back at me like, "What does she think is so funny?" I was like, "I guess you just." A woman who grew up on David Lynch.
Yeah, it's like a little club that we kind of all have cards to, and we find another one. It's very exciting. It's like we were saying in the promo before you hopped in that you ending your sets on Fire Island with Fire Walk With Me music.
Yes.
I mean, I love you more than I can even say on a podcast, that just made you even bigger in my heart, where I was just like, it's a club. Like, it's something that we all have that it's like a shorthand.
It's one of my favorite sign-off songs, The Pink Room, from Fire Walk With Me. It's such a great song, and it's like I can think about it and just get goosebumps. It's beautiful. It's such a good song, and it's one of those things that I've taken it and I've extended it, so it's like 20 minutes long, and it just loops and loops and loops and loops.
And it's a long loop, as it is all by itself, too.
But it's so fabulous. And it's a great, great ceremonial ending of a.
When did you start doing that?
So usually on Fire Island. That's not true. Last Halloween, I DJ'd at PEM at the Peabody Essex Museum for Halloween, I programmed The Pink Room as the last song, but then we ran out of time and my last song was The Cocteau Twins, which is perfectly, perfectly acceptable. But then when I started doing Queerdo out on Fire Island, it became the sort of signature last song. And it's a great kind of transition song.
Yeah.
It's very slow and it's very atmospheric, but it's got those, you know, just like huge drums. So it sounds cool and
very sexy.
It's really very sexy, and it's really great film a really great song when the light starts to change and it goes from, you know, the sun is set and it's getting dark and that And always it's one of those songs that when you play it, if you know, you know. And the people who know run up to you and are like, oh my God, I can't believe you're playing this. Nice, yes. Fellow. So Fire Island. It's like, Fire Walk With Me Island.
Yes, exactly.
Fire Walk With Me
Island. What I said to you. Oh my gosh.
Oh my gosh.
Just do my aunt game. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I love him so much. And I love David Lynch's commitment and love of his actors, and the actors who show up regularly are always so great. Yeah. Jack Nance. I love that that's his favorite actor. And it makes sense when you hear David Lynch talk, how like Jack Nance is kind of his sort of mm-hmm. on-screen persona or his avatar.
Yeah.
And that weird line delivery and his like kind of slow pacing and his kind of strange affectation of everything, but it's wholly and completely natural to him. And I love that. I love him. I love the name of the actress who plays Sarah Palmer, Laura yes. Palmer's mom.
Grace Zabriskie.
Yes, yeah. And her character in Inland Empire. What the yeah. hell is oh that God. Scene? Oh, it's so good. And he's just like, everybody is so creepy. And the women, his women all have this kind of undercurrent of wantonness that I kind of am obsessed with. There, it's not entirely true to the women that I know in my life, yeah. but in the David Lynch universe, that sort of, you know, it's kind of like every woman has a dark secret. And I love that.
Fatale. Yeah. His love of women just in general in film just seeps through all of his movies. You know, maybe Eraserhead, not as much. Eraserhead is a fear of
yes,
women.
I think definitely. But like,
yeah, from Blue Velvet on, I feel like he gives such compassion in the way that he shows women, and he seems to respect those characters a lot more than the male characters in his movie. Like,
I think in Twin Peaks you definitely see like the more set. There's like the sensitive couple. There's like Peggy Lipton's character who works at the diner, and she's very sympathetic and kind and soft and lovely, soft spoken and blah. And then Leo's wife, what the hell, Shelley, yeah. who is just a regular girl in a bad situation. And I find her very believable and accessible. And
yeah.
And I knew girls like that in school and college yeah. and in the Northwest and in my life. And Donna was a very real character, very sensitive and lovely. And then Audrey just had all the chutzpah that I aspired to have, and so much practice with the cherry stem trying to tie that into a knot. Still can't. My sister Mary can.
Used to be able to do that.
Which is pretty impressive.
Two. My own horn.
I've got access to cherries in the Bosch. I should try it again. A little older right. now. More experience.
My tongue is new.
Oh my gosh. This is so amazing. Thank you so much, Miss Anna, for coming in.
My
and
pleasure.
Sharing this amazing, amazing insight.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Yeah,
call me back when you want to talk about Jodorowsky.
That's so weird that you said that. Do you know what our episode is next week?
Jodorowsky. Holy Mountain! Is it?
Yeah, we're talking about Jodorowsky next week. That's our next episode. We're for the new season, we kind of did a history of midnight movies last week.
Fabulous.
I was talking about kind of like the 6 to 8 like big movies that kind of started that whole trend. And then we're doing deeper dives into a bunch of them. So, yeah.
Fabulous. Well, Holy Mountain is one of those films that like Eraserhead, you just kind of strap in and put, you know, go along for the ride. And it's a little bit more, it's more clear what that movie is about.
Is it?
It's, you know, it's very clear. It's about enlightenment.
Yeah.
It's about enlightenment. And Jodorowsky will tell you what it's about. Yeah. It's about enlightenment. And rewatching it, it's also really interesting. There are no shadows in that film at all. Okay. Watch it again. Because I actually got to sit next to Jodorowsky at dinner because he came to speak in New York at the Museum of Art and Design.
Yeah.
And I donated some money to help fly him over. So I got to sit next to him at dinner, and I'm sitting next to him and across from Debbie Harry. So it's like idle tennis.
Oh my God. I went to the screening. the thing you're talking about, I went to that screening and took some pictures while he was up there talking.
Yeah.
And then said hi to him for like a split second after it was over, but it was like kind of chaos.
I was there.
So overwhelmed and so excited that he was in person. It was the most starstruck I've ever felt in my life, was like that he was right there. But
that was amazing.
Yeah,
that, can we fly him back?
Had
his birthday like a couple days.
I know. And he gave me a little quick tarot card reading, which was like,
I'm so jealous of you right now.
I know, it's pretty fucking cool. And I was on tour. The band, like, I literally like hopped on a plane, came over, then hopped on a plane the next day to go back on tour.
Oh my God.
But this, I was like, I'm not missing this. He's in his
80s.
I love.
Yeah, it's my favorite.
I love.
My favorite filmmaker of all time. He's such a.
He's amazing.
And he's amazing. The opposite of David Lynch in so many ways. Like, where David doesn't like to describe things. Alejandro will talk about his movies in such depth, you know, like, and he'll tell you every little thing. This was painted green because of this, and this means this, and this means this. And I love it.
Totally.
You can just like get so deep into, and his stuff is so layered. Like,
Yeah, it's amazing. And what's interesting is that I think Twin Peaks ultimately is about the levels of existence. And levels of consciousness, and that, and ultimately Twin Peaks is David Lynch's meditation on meditation.
Okay.
And it's not just the horrors of life. I mean, Agent Cooper is absolutely 100% his meditation on meditation, and staying Zen through horrors, you know? Jodorowsky's films are also about levels of existence and levels of perception and levels of the mind and the way that perception is formed. And he takes a much more direct and spiritual route and goes with the holiness, whereas David Lynch is just like surreal and cuckoo-la-la, you know, like down into the darkness with no handles. He doesn't really want to give you handles, whereas Jodorowsky does. So fun. So exciting.
That's my
so
goodness.
Cool. You're my favorite.
We will have you back, absolutely, because this was just mind-blowing. I love your brain. Thank you.
Thank you. What about my dirty pillows? Those are pretty good too. All right. Thank you so much for having me. It was a blast.
Thank you. Tell our listeners where they can follow you and get more Anna in their lives.
You can follow me on Instagram. That's where I post the most, at Ms. Onimatronic, M.S. Onimatronic. And you can come see me on Sundays at Balcon in Hell's Kitchen. I DJ and do a little kiki there pretty much every Sunday. I'm not there every Sunday, but I'm there at least 2 to 3 Sundays out of the month.
Nice.
And I'll be on Fire Island this summer again. So come to the Ice Palace. Absolutely. I'll probably be there.
Yes, and we'll be there dancing too. So come and hang out with all of us.
Yes, definitely.
Yes,
definitely. Oh my gosh, yeah. And we have friends mutual friends who just bought a house there. So I imagine we'll be convening there very
absolutely.
Often.
Yeah. We love you to pieces, honey. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Love you guys. Bye.
She's just so great.
I
love that human.
I just love her. What a treat. So now what are we going to talk about?
Well, I mean, I feel like there's still so much we can't talk about this movie. There's so much.
in the last episode, we talked a little bit about, while we were talking the history of midnight movies, we kind of talked about this a little bit, but not a whole lot. The production of this movie was crazy. Yes. Like, it was very, I mean, quelle surprise, but it was very unlike most film productions. And I think it was a good way of, like, showing what was in store with the career of this man, because he doesn't ever do anything the way everyone else tends to, thank goodness. I gave you homework to tell the kids a little bit about the making of Eraserhead and the distribution. What did you find in your studies?
In my studies?
But before we get too deep into it, we'll just say that Eraserhead was made in 1977 by David Lynch. It was created over the course of, depending on who you ask, everyone kind of has their own stories about the making of this movie, especially because David doesn't talk about anything. So it's like, you're left with like the crew and the cast kind of like their memories of it. But it was the 70s. There was a lot of drugs. People don't remember everything super the same. But judging on who you ask, it took between 4 and 6 years to make this movie, which is banana sauce. Like, just crazy. And it starred Jack Nance as the titular Eraserhead character, Charlotte Stewart, Jack Fisk. Jack Fisk is really cool because he's also a art director, and he is Sissy Spacek's husband. So Sissy Spacek and Jack Fisk were very heavily involved in this film as well. Yeah,
so cool.
Jean Bates, Judith Ann Roberts, and Laurel Neer is the main cast. It's a really like a one-hander, two-hander movie for the most part, unless you're counting the baby, and then it's like a three-hander. But it's mostly just Jack Nance. And a lot of you guys that are David Lynch newbies might not know, but a lot of these cast members are also in other David Lynch movies. And you can see Jack Nance in Twin Peaks, along with Catherine Coulson, who we're going to get into because we're obsessed with her, especially Maddie.
I love her so much.
Yeah. Catherine Coulson is known as the Log Lady.
Yay.
In Twin Peaks. But yeah, she was basically like the other director.
She was the assistant director. She was a camera operator. She was in charge of electrical. She
made sandwiches.
She made sandwiches. They all did. There's an entire food room at AFI that they spent so much time on. I was watching this really kind of cool snippet on Criterion where they kind of go back to the filming location on the back lot. So this entire movie was filmed over the 4 years. It was filmed in this back little kind of, not garage, but this back open lot area at AFI. And
yeah, they almost look like barns.
Yeah, exactly. Like stables almost. And they continually over the 4 years would have to build and then rebuild their sets, and then rebuild, because they would have to get taken.
Because it was years, you know, and they were
it
like,
was years.
You guys, we have other things going on here. I just remember, like, film school, too, you usually have, like, 2 weeks to make something. And I like the idea that they were like, we're just going to use this space that nobody cares about.
And
just set up shop in the back and make our weird little movie.
Forever. Yeah, because he... David Lynch was the second class. It was a brand new independent filmmaker grant that had a kind of one class before them that had been passed out, and he was part of the second class, but it was not a lot of money. And throughout this production, they were continually running out of money. Everybody was, it was part of, they would show up to set with, you know, like just a pack of tape. You know, a pack of films so they could record and shoot that day, and working so many other jobs that were all going directly right back into the film.
Yeah, I love that. Like, it was like a team effort like that, and they like even used film from other movies. Yeah. Like, I remember we watched a documentary and they had talked about how Paper Moon was being filmed at the same time, which is one of my favorite movies of all time, and Peter Bogdanovich movie, but it's all black and white, and they had extra film from that, you know, because that was like a legit studio production, and they just got some black and white film from Paper Moon and started using that day, you know. Like, cool, get the baby, let's make another scene.
We got time, we got it, we got the needs, you know. I mean, David Lynch was doing some crazy like hour-long paper route every day, like that the entire cast would also help him on, just so they could be putting all this money back into the movie.
Which is just adorable to think about. Did you ever have a paper route?
I always wanted one. My parents wouldn't let me have one.
God, we had one when I was growing up. and it was like a family operation. So it reminded me of that when they were talking about it. Just the fact of like the worst thing, I still have nightmares about it where you have to like, you have to roll the paper and then you have to put the rubber band on it and your fingers would get like raw from like touching rubber bands for like an hour. And then your hands were just black, like covered with newsprint.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was so apparently gross. Jack Nance had one at the same time, but he only lasted 2 weeks doing it.
It's grueling. Yeah. It's so grueling. My mom used to have this band that we called the Scooby-Doo band that was like the ugliest, like three colors of brown, ugly, ugly band. And we would drive down the streets with the door open, and my sister and I would just jump out the side like we were like little monkeys and then run. I jumped back in. And we did that, and that's how we bought our first like VCR. You know, it was like the kid money that we needed.
It was your allowance. Yeah, your allowance.
Yeah, it's like go work for your money.
I love that.
Sometimes I'd wear a little Newsies cap so that I felt like I was like old timey. Get your paper.
My dad actually has my dad's a bronze sculptor, and he has multiple newspaper sculptures. I always wanted a paper route because we had like the pouch that you would like have because he needed it for because my sister was the model for it. But I would always get dressed up in it and play around,
just cosplay and pretend you were a paper boy.
But I was never allowed to have one.
Well, let me just tell you, it's not as fun as it seems like it is. But I love the idea of the whole cast and crew of Eraserhead running around doing a paper route.
It was funny. There was this little clip of David saying that he would be finishing up his entire route and then drive up and then see Jack still like putting all the rubber bands still on his papers and hadn't even started.
It takes forever
to do that. No, I was like, oh gosh. Yeah, that only lasts 2 weeks. That would have been me. That would have been me.
No. So this went on, you know, for years and years.
Yeah, and
poor Jack Nance had to keep his hairstyle like that for years.
This went on so long because Catherine calls him the log lady and Jack were actually married during the beginning of filming. They went through a divorce through filming and then still she was doing his hair every time that they were shooting, even after their divorce. So it was a long, drawn out process, but the crew was so tight. You know, it was such, I mean, almost all of these people continued to work with David for the rest of his career. You know, he was even saying that that Jack was originally supposed to be the Elephant Man. But with complications, it was filming in England and it just wasn't possible to make it happen.
Plus, that was this first like studio thing where they were like, no, we're going to do something legitimate. We're going to keep you John Hurt and Anthony Hopkins.
Said, I guess John Hurt did a great job.
That guy. Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah. And we did talk about like the distribution of this a little bit, that it like was released originally. It kind of bombed. It got scathing reviews from Variety. A lot of the critics were calling it pretentious and nonsensical or dark for the sake of being dark, and none of those things are wrong. But what's funny is it's very much a thing that we talk about on this show a lot about hindsight of 2020. Like I've been looking back at things with a different perspective, but now when you look at reviews of this movie, it has like a 90% on Rotten Tomatoes. It is beloved by pretty much every critic. Will say that it's incredible now. But back in 1977, it was like, what is this horse shit? This hurts my eyes, hurts my ears, gave me nightmares.
I mean,
this is not a horror movie. It's just a gross baby. Like, what is this even supposed to be? Like, no one had ever seen anything like it. And I would venture to say that no one's really ever seen anything like it since, you know.
Okay,
except for my film school team. I mean, but, you know. It's inspired so much that there's a lot of stuff that has a very similar energy to it in all sorts of media. But for the most part, especially at this time, the only thing that it could even be compared to was some of the surrealist work of like, you know, Brühl or like Salvador Dali or something. Like it was a weird surrealist experimental movie. And the fact that it did so well once they moved it to being a midnight movie, that it could play for years and years and years, meant that there was like an audience for it, that people were hungry for things that weren't just piecemealed to them and easy.
And, you know, and it goes to show, I mean, that's one thing that I kind of took from all of this is that how highbrow some people try and kind of make this movie and be like, oh, it's so important. There's so much stuff. I don't know if that's the case. You know, I mean, sometimes you just need to absorb it. Like, it was a quote from Charlotte Stewart. She said, the film's viewers should let it wash over them and marinate. It's, and if that means seeing it stoned, if that means seeing it in a room full of other people, like, it's not necessarily something that has to be overanalyzed. This is just kind of a snap picture of a guy's life who suddenly has a baby, you know? And feels very trapped.
I mean, a lot of people say that this is David Lynch. Everyone tries to give it this important whatever. But a lot of people, and myself kind of included, think that this is David Lynch's, like, take on fear of male fear. Mm-hmm. You know, like, this is basically, like, the fear of relationships, the fear of having a child, the fear of growing up and these things that come with that. Other people say that it's like David Lynch's take on, like, the terrors of Philadelphia, you know, like, of living in an industrial American city, which can then be seen in movies that he does later, showing this, like, he has this, like, nightmare scape of suburbia and of big cities, and showing the dark underbelly of a lot of those. That's a really, really recurring theme through a lot of David Lynch's pieces, you know, like, almost all of them have to do with Twin Peaks and Blue Velvet are, like, very good examples of, like, the dark side of suburbia and the dark side of, like, a small mm-hmm. town, things that are hit below the surface. This was more like the emptiness and the anxiety that, like, is caused by big cities and, you know, living in industrial space. But often it's really like the fear of, like,
an adult
settling down and having a kid, you know, like,
I think that it's the fear of adulthood. And a fear of mm-hmm. all of the unknown of how to having all these expectations put upon you, you know, of, oh, you have a kid, you have a wife, you have a job, that's what you have to do now. And that feeling of continually being trapped. Why I think that people can tend to overanalyze this movie. The script is 20 pages. It wasn't even a script. You know, it wasn't a script. There's nothing to analyze. There's no real dialogue to analyze. It is a collection of assorted moments that,
and it's like, yeah, a lot of David Lynch's stuff is more the mood that it gives and the vibe,
the visceral experience, the modern, you know? Like,
technology for it. Yeah, it's not really like he doesn't, and I don't think that he's very pretentious. I think that he has ideas and he's just really gutsy and just makes things because he likes to make stuff. And then our culture is, I mean, look at, we have a podcast where we go through movies and stuff. This is, like, what people do now. Like, we like, and we've been doing this for a very long time. We like to overanalyze art and, like, and really find out why and what this means. And sometimes it's just because. I think a lot of David Lynch's stuff is just because, or, like, he makes things because it makes you feel something. Or it makes you experience something. And you're not meant to, like, figure it out. You're meant to, like, just let it wash over you.
Yeah.
And have an experience.
That I mean, like,
which,
like,
is how I usually tell people to watch David Lynch movie. Because they're all a little bit different, but they all are an experience. You know, and they're meant to be seen in movie theaters. And he has a big thing with, like, making sure your volume is as loud as it possibly can be, because he's very specific with sound design for all of his movies, you know. It was a big thing that, like, during Cannes, when he did Wild at Heart, which ended up winning, like, the Palme d'Or, but also had the most walkouts of any movie that year, like, they showed Wild at Heart, they made the sound so loud that it was deafening to people. Like, there are moments with, like, fire and, like, and they became jump scares because the sound was so loud. And that's on purpose, you know? And this movie was like that, too. The soundtrack, which is also created mostly by him, like, he had a couple musicians come in and help play, but this movie, David Lynch, like, wrote it, directed it, produced it, did the score, did the special editing effects. He did everything. Yeah, he was like the original Robert Rodriguez. Like, he's like, I don't need a crew. We'll just have the log lady and me, and we're just going to make a movie.
Yeah, you know, and so much of it is, I feel, a great example of working with what you have. You know, it's what can we make in this back lot? This is the space we have. We only have this room. We can only...
Which is, you know, so inspiring.
Like, we can, all right, this is what we got, but this is what we're going to make out of it. And that's it. That's the reason why. That's the reason why, when there's only X amount of, you know, kind of scenes that are set somewhere, you know, it's, that's all they had to work with.
Yeah. It's so dark because they had to film at night. Like, they weren't allowed to use those spaces during the day because it was a school. There was other things going on. So the second the sun went down, they would go in and start filming. And they would stop filming when they heard birds on the soundtrack. Like, birds, birds. And then they'd have to stop for the night because they would hear birds in the recording, and they had to call it a day and maybe come back in 3 weeks and do another
night. It was really funny. It was just such a really close crew. I mean, they were talking about how they would all be taking turns making meals, and how even in the food room, how Jack Nance even took a stab at planting potatoes on like a balcony. And when they harvested them, they were about the size of a fingernail. And they were just little tiny potatoes. Yeah,
potatoes are not very satisfying to make grow. I remember I brought home a bunch of potato things that were like, I guess, not real potatoes. Do you remember that? And I was like, this is called the potato vine. And then they looked like little monsters, and we didn't get them. I was like, it's kind of weird to grow them when they're $2 for a huge bag of potatoes. So like, it's kind of
pointless. But yeah, you know, it was a group of young artists that were just wanting to make something, you know, and
which I think you could take as inspiration now, and listeners should, you know, like, this is the most exciting way to make art, in my opinion. You know, like, make what you can with what you got, and you'd be surprised what you can actually accomplish. Half of my career has been that, you know, I'll photograph what I can, when I can. And you never know what you're going to come up with. And that kind of community building can lead to so much. Like, everybody involved in this movie joined together and made something amazing that lasted forever. And then they made so many other projects together, and their roles.
My favorite part about this entire production was when, you know, they really talked about how they all sat down for dinner at a diner, and they set out everyone's points, you know, because David wanted them to, everybody got a point of the production. So if the movie ever made money, which they never knew if it would, but all of their time and work and blood, sweat, tears, all of that, you know, they're still making money off of it. All of these people, like, going around asking, they needed a few hundred dollars from this person or a few hundred dollars from that person. Like, those people are still getting returns on that investment because David made sure that they got the points for that, which I think is so cool.
That is super, super cool. And he also, like, I remember hearing that, you know, a lot of times production stopped because he couldn't pay people, and people would be like, that's all right, we're not doing this to make money. And he was like, no, you're going to get paid something, which is so rare in this type of filmmaking. Like, there are so many low budget things that are made where people just take the, like, oh, I'm not going to make a penny off of doing this. I'm doing this just for fun. But the fact that he had the integrity to make sure that everyone did get something, and they would stop filming for 6 months or something because he couldn't afford to pay anybody, and then start up again when he had a little chunk of money that he could give to each person. Just shows that's his so integrity cool. And makes him very cool.
Bravo, David Lynch. Thank you.
Bravo. Yes. Good on you. And over the years, it has become a huge part of the zeitgeist and a huge part of our collective film, you know, history. In 2004, the National Film Registry included it in their list of movies that need to be preserved because of, you know, the cultural impact that they've had. It was one of the first cult movies to be put into that. So it's, you know, preserved. You see those little things about, like, Martin Scorsese talking about the red shoes and how they, like, preserve this movie. It's one of those. It's up there with, like, all these movies that are considered the greatest films of all time. And in 2010, the Online Film Critics, I'm not really sure who these critics are, but the Online Film Critics did an entire poll, basically, of the 100 best debuts by a director of all time. So 100 different movies that were the most impressive movies made by a first-time director. And Eraserhead made number 2 out of the 100, and it's only behind Orson Welles' Citizen
Kane. Wow.
So critics fucking love this movie now. It's a lot different than back in 77 when they were like, this is art school pretentious. Again, to my film teacher.
Fuck you.
You don't know. And it went on to influence so many things, and not just other films. Like, for example, like Darren Aronofsky's first film, Pi, is heavily influenced by Eraserhead.
Yes.
In that it's difficult to watch and it's very dense and confusing and in black and white. Tetsuyo, which is a really great like Japanese film, is also heavily influenced by it. A fun movie that you wouldn't think of is The Shining. The Shining, Stanley Kubrick and Lynch met, and Stanley Kubrick often said that Eraserhead was his favorite movie of all time, which I think is really fascinating. And it wasn't that old when he started working on The Shining, and he made everybody involved in The Shining watch Eraserhead. And when they watched it and were like, why did we just watch this movie? He's like, because that's the tone I want The Shining now.
Wow.
In addition to being super, super inspiring in movies, David Lynch also found his way inspiring pretty much every other type of media. Like he was huge with musicians. My favorite example is the Pixies, which is my favorite band. Pixies do a song called In Heaven, Everything is Fine, the Lady in the Radiator song. And that is from Eraserhead. And it's a cover. Both Frank Black and Kim Deal have had turns singing it in different performances. It makes me so warmly happy to hear an obscure song from a big cheek lady in a radiator being sung by my favorite band. A ton of musicians that use this kind of Eraserhead imagery in their music. Another visual artist too, like you could just throw a stick at any artist that were in the 80s, weird black and white art. Almost always Eraserhead is the big thing. One of my favorite people that was heavily inspired by him was H.R. Giger, who is known as the guy who created like the alien monsters and stuff. David Lynch, however, wasn't so appreciative. David Lynch doesn't like being copied very much. And
he doesn't like being disrespected.
Giger was not shy about saying that that David Lynch's Eraserhead was a huge influence on his visual art. So much so that when time came around to doing Dune, which was its own debacle and deserves its own episode, especially maybe we'll cook something up because Dune is coming out again and we could do a Dune dive. David Lynch declined working with H.R. Giger on Dune, even though Giger was very interested in being a part of it, because he had stolen so many ideas from
him
that he was like, Oh, thank you. I don't want you a partner.
No pie for you.
And Giger's like, oh, shit. And a big reason that Giger was so keen on jumping onto Dune was because before David Lynch took over and created his version of Dune, my favorite director, who we just talked about with Anna, Alejandro Jodorowsky, was supposed to do a Dune movie. He was working on it, and it is its own episode as well. It is a huge, epic project that involved every amazing musician and artist from that time period in the 70s. And Giger designed the spaceships and all sorts of like costumes and art direction for this movie that never ended up getting made. So then they give the movie to David Lynch. Giger's like, hello, I'm Giger. I am weird and edgy and dark. Maybe you know of me. And David Lynch is like, yeah, I know of you, and I don't want you anywhere near this. You've already put me off. It's so ballsy and so funny. And then, you know, sometimes imitation is a form of flattery, and other times imitation will get you kicked off.
Yeah, exactly.
So
no,
be careful who you copycat. So, I mean, this was such a treat to get to talk to one of our friends about movies and to have another person that saw this way too young. I think the takeaway from this is if you're a parent and listening to this, and we get this a lot. A lot of our friends have started making little babies and have children now, and our siblings have children. And often it's like, when are certain things age appropriate? Mm-hmm. I think I'm probably the worst person to usually ask about this, but
maybe
I would say that I'm noticing a trend that if you let your kids watch Eraserhead before puberty, they're probably going to grow up to be amazing, cool people.
You're not wrong.
And if you need any proof, just look at me and Miss Anna. It was good enough for us, so it'll be good enough for your kids, too. I think it's important to show your kids things that are going to make their brains work a little bit harder.
And having the ability to have that open conversation about it, you know? It just gets those juices pumping and showing them
Yeah, how nice was it to hear Anna say that, like, her mom would, like, encourage them to see stuff so that, they could have conversation.
Nothing was off limits as long as they could talk about it afterwards.
As opposed to my childhood where we had to have recorded movies with different titles so that we could watch things in private in our latchkey times. Like, let's watch Eraserhead alone at 4 o'clock in the afternoon before mom gets home from work. And the tape says Bambi, but it's really that. You know, like, I think that's, it's healthier to get to have a dialogue with your kid about what you're watching. If you're like chomping at the bit to get more David Lynch into your life after hearing this, and who wouldn't be, because we just made it all sound so much fun. And I love that we talked about a lot more than just Eraserhead, because his movies are so inspiring to me and clearly to Anna, and there's a deep dive you can do. There's a lot of really, really good things you can watch. I would like to suggest some goodies. The movie he did after Eraserhead was Elephant Man. We talked about it a little bit with Anna. It does star Anthony Hopkins and John Hurt. It is black and white also, but it was, you know, an Oscar nominated movie. It was a big drama at the time. And it's a true story based off of like a case of elephantitis, the guy that was working in like sideshows. So it has like circus vibes to it. It also is like a medical drama. It has the infamous line, "I am not an animal. I am a human being." So if you've ever heard someone say that, they're talking about an elephant man. Elephant Man also blends into the original Dune that he did. It is my least favorite David Lynch movie, but it is the movie that I want to watch soon so that I can refresh before the other Dune, because I don't remember the second half of the movie at all because I always fall asleep. So for compare and contrast, Dune is something worth watching. And you can see Sting in really tiny panties, and that alone makes it like worth entry.
Didn't he like almost try to get his name taken off of it?
Yeah, for a long time in the 80s, they were like, David Lynch wanted to take his name off of this movie. And I don't know that that's 100% true, but it is the least Lynchy movie he's ever made. Exception of one that I'll bring up, but it doesn't feel very David Lynchy a lot of times, but it was also the first time that like studios really like came in and told him what to do. That left such a bad taste in his mouth that you will notice he never lets that happen ever again in the rest of his career. Like every other movie is so him, because he learned from Dune just how shitty it can be when a studio comes in and kind of like mansplains how to be a director to you, you know, and makes notes upon notes upon notes. But it does show the first time of him working with Kyle MacLachlan, who becomes kind of his male young leading man to use, you know, which continues into Blue Velvet, which I'm wearing on my shirt right now. I'm wearing a Blue Velvet. Blue Velvet is a masterpiece, 100% a masterpiece. And if you're into Blue Velvet, I'd say dip into Twin Peaks. You heard us talk about it a lot. Dip into Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me cautiously. It is deceptively dark. Like it starts out sort of, it's about what happened to Laura Palmer before she wound up wrapped in plastic in the
beginning. So what the kids would say, triggering.
As they would say, it is a very triggering movie. It has a lot to do with abuse, and it is a hard watch, but it is a really, really, really well done movie. Plus it's got David Bowie in it and all sorts of little treats. I would also recommend these latter films a little bit. I would say that, I mean, all of Twin Peaks is incredible, but if you jump into Wild at Heart, which me and Anna talked about a lot, that is my favorite to watch. It's also like, I feel like it's the lightest. It's still heavy, and there's still some really fucked up shit in that movie too. But I find it really enjoyable, and it's almost like his sexy comedy. Right. It's sort of like the same vibe as Natural Born Killers, a True Romance, or Badlands, and this kind of like lovers on the run. Laura Dern's never been sexier and cuter. Nicolas Cage is so hot in it. Laura Dern's own mother plays her mother in the movie and does, I think, the best acting in that film. Like, she is just bonkers. It's a delight. And if you want some newer things, he hasn't made a movie since Inland Empire, which is, Anna did talk about that a little bit too. Inland Empire, I would say, is the most difficult watch of his movies, just because it doesn't really make sense. And if your brain is trying to make sense of it, which it will naturally do because we are monkeys that try to figure things out, it's going to be very disappointing because it doesn't make any sense at all. But it does a lot of Laura Dern, and Laura Dern is incredible in it. And David Lynch even started an Oscar campaign for Laura Dern on his front lawn and did like for your consideration thing for Laura Dern. So people that drove by could see big signs. So, I mean, it is Laura Dern's best acting. My two favorite dark ones to watch that are kind of sexy and kind of weird, but very, very fun are Lost Highway.
Yes, very.
and Mulholland Drive. Okay. And I think both of those are just such a showcase for like Patricia Arquette in the first one. And then Naomi Watts just blows everybody away when you watch it. Plus it has Justin Theroux being sexy. Both of those movies are dark, fun, fabulous soundtracks. And if you're like, I like David Lynch, but all this stuff is so fucked up. And isn't he just, why can't you just be normal, David? Then I suggest you watch his one normal movie, which is a movie called The Straight Story, about a man who basically rides a tractor across the country. It is a very sweet little movie. And it is the only David Lynch movie you will find on Disney Plus. He tries to do his little something for everyone, but everything he does is for the weirdos. So if you are one of us, then, and you don't know all the David Lynch magic that's out there in the world, I suggest you plug in, put it on, and go to another dimension. Yeah. Preferably one red curtains, some statues, and some chevron floors. David Lynch is a delight. And Animatronic was a delight
and
today.
And you know who else was a delight?
And I am so happy.
The little woman in the radiator.
The little woman.
The little woman.
There's a little woman in my radiator. And she's got a very poofy cheek.
Chipmunk.
And she's singing, heaven, everything is fine. You've got your good thing, and I've got mine. And it's called The Dirty Pillows Podcast. Thanks for listening to it today, you guys. We really appreciate it, and we love talking with you.
Please leave us a rate, review. They actually really do mean a lot. We'd appreciate it. Thank you guys so much. You can follow us.
Yeah, please give us a 5 stars.
5 stars.
And talk about why you like us.
Follow us on Instagram, Dirty Pillows Podcast, all the things. And on top of that, we want you guys to remember something very, very important.
Never forget that we love you. To death. Stay spooky. We'll see you next week.
No.
Farewell, adieu to you, fair Spanish ladies.